Prior to beginning the meeting, we will do a roll call, see who we have on the telephone line. This is the PUC Commission meeting in Pier. Is Jim Overcash on the line?
I am, Commissioner.
Mary Sisick.
This is Ben Dickens appearing in her stead.
Sorry, could you say that again? It was a bit muddled.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, absolutely.
Hi, this is Ben Dickens, and I'm appearing in her place.
Wonderful. Great. Thanks, Mr. Dickens. Meredith Moore.
Present, Mr. Commissioner.
Great, thanks. Steve Kolbeck.
Yes, I'm here, Commissioner.
Welcome, Steve.
Thank you.
Daniel Off.
Dana Steele and Denise Hargan.
Is joining the meeting.
Danny, are you online?
Yes.
I am, Mr. Great, Commissioner. Thank you.
Marlene Bennett.
Present, Mr. Chairman.
Good morning. Tal Wazorek. I think I saw Tal here in Pier. Steve Rowell.
What was that?
Steve Rowell. Rowell. Denise Hargan, Donna Steele?
Yes, Dana Steele.
Dana Steele, great. Thanks,
Thank
for
you.
And Jerry Reisenauer?
Yes, Commissioner, I'm on.
Great, thanks, Jerry. All right. This is Tuesday, November 28, 2006, at approximately 9:30 a.m. here in the State Capitol Building, room 468. This is the time and place for the South Dakota Public Utilities meeting. I'm Commissioner Dusty Johnson. Joining me here in Pier is Commissioner Gary Hansen. We will start with the agenda of the commission meeting with Consumer Reports number 1, status report on consumer utility inquiries and complaints received by the commission. Ms. Gregg.
Thank you, Chairman Johnson. The commission has received a total of 72 contacts since the last report was prepared for the November 14, 2006 commission meeting. 21 of the contacts involved telecommunications, 5 of the contacts involved electrical services, 18 contacts involved natural gas, 7 contacts involved cellular phone service, 12 contacts related to the Do Not Call Registry, and 9 contacts related to issues not regulated by the PUC. 1,925 of the 2,243 complaints received in 2006 have been resolved, and 1,692 of the 1,885 complaints received in 2005 have been resolved.
Thanks very much, Ms. Gregg. Are there any questions for Ms. Gregg? Hearing none, before proceeding on with our agenda, I'll note two other items. First off, Telecom 1, we will move to the back of the agenda. And secondly, we have a new commission employee joining us. We were very sad to see Carol Zabrowski go, but we are happy to see Damaris Axthelm with us. So welcome, Damaris. That will proceed to consumer complaint item number 1, CT05-001. And this is in the matter of the complaint filed by WWC. License LLC against Golden West Telecom Cooperative Incorporated and the other Golden West companies regarding intercarrier billings. Question before the commission today is, how shall the commission rule regarding charges assessed by Golden West against WWC for transiting services? There have been briefings, and we have also received oral arguments on this at the last commission meeting. With that, a motion is in order. I would just note that rather than just vote, I think I'll try to lay out what my intention is here. And then if it's all right with Commissioner Hansen, I might get the party's viewpoints on the procedural component of this, not necessarily the ruling of the commission, but on whether or not the time frame I've laid out makes sense. So with that, I would move that the commission find in part for Golden West and deny WWC's claim for a refund of amounts charged by Golden West for transiting WWC's intra-MTA traffic from Golden West Rapid City Meet Point to the Indian Telephone Company's customer end office, and either paid by WWC to Golden West or credited by Golden West against monies otherwise owed to WWC. I further move, however, that the commission find in part for WWC and grant its claim for refund of transiting charges to the extent that such charges were for inter-MTA traffic, based on Golden West's admissions in the record that it did not bill other carriers for this traffic. Because the terms of the party's settlement are not known to the commission, we don't know how the terms of the agreement may affect the calculation of the refund amount for inter-MTA traffic and of interest on this amount. I therefore move the WWC file its calculations of the inter-MTA refund amount and explanations of them by December 15th of this year, and that Golden West file its responsive calculations and explanation on December 22nd of this year, and that WWC file any reply calculations and explanation by December 29th, 2006. I further move that, except to the extent that the settlement agreement establishes other terms governing the interest applicable to the inter-MTA transiting charges at issue, the Commission find and conclude that interest shall be calculated at a rate of 10% simple interest in accordance with SDCL 21-1-13.1 and applicable case law, and that the interest rate set forth in Section 7.2.4 of the agreement is not applicable to these charges. Lastly, I would just encourage the parties to communicate and cooperate regarding the determination of the refund and interest amounts under this decision, and if possible, to reach a final accord on the transiting issue to bring this matter to final conclusion. With that, if it's acceptable to you, sir, I would ask the parties if they have any concerns about the timeline laid out in the motion prior to the commissioners voting on the motion. Mr. Resort?
I don't have a concern about the timeline. Perhaps, though, it's about as part of the motion, the commission to grant commission counsel the ability to extend those timelines for good cause shown to commission counsel. And just my concern being if coming out of Thanksgiving and people have a number of things trying to come by the end of the year, but we can get everybody lined up for
I think that's an excellent suggestion. Ms. Rogers, any comments? Great. Thanks very much. Mr. Smith, any concerns about the suggestion made by Mr. Zork?
No, that sounds like a workable plan to me. And, again, I think our thought here was just trying to push it along, and if we can, maybe try to put a wrap on this by the end of the year. But I totally understand what you're talking about, and we just had to throw something out, and we could either achieve it or not. Can I bring up the one other thought? One other thought is that I had, and again, is the demand by Western Wireless for a commission order requiring a cash refund by a date certain. And then we've had statements, and again, I don't know the status of the record exactly on that. I can't remember off the top of my head, and I didn't dig into it, to the effect that there have been various other transiting amounts that have been withheld since some date, and I'm not sure exactly when that is. Whether or not, and maybe you can address this at that time in connection with these discussions, whether since there are currently incurred other charges, and again, you guys, without giving away any disputes you have concerning that, whether a credit mechanism is appropriate in this case because you have currently offsetting charges instead of future charges, or whether this should be the order should ultimately be written as a requirement that it be paid in cash by check by a date certain. Just some thoughts, and maybe you can talk that over and work it out.
No, that's a very good comment, Mr. Smith. I would amend my motion to incorporate the suggestions made by Mr. Wazorek that schedule can be altered by the Commission General Counsel if a good cause is shown to Mr. Smith. I make that motion.
I'll second the motion.
Motion is made, seconded, and carries. We'll proceed into the telecommunications portion of the docket, skipping to item number 2, which is TC06-175, and that's in the matter of the petition of Sprint Communications Company, LP, for arbitration pursuant to the Telecom Act of 96 to resolve issues relating to an interconnection agreement with ITC Incorporated. Question before the Commission is, today shall the Commission establish a procedural schedule? And I would look to Ms. Wiest to tee this one up.
Yes, I think we would probably want to take that one and the next one together.
Good point. We'll also take in number 3, which is TC06-176, and that's in the matter of the petition of Sprint Communications Company, LP, for arbitration pursuant to the Telecom Act of 96 to resolve issues relating to the interconnection agreement with the City of Brookings, doing business as Swift Telecommunications. And the same question is before the Commission. Shall the Commission establish a procedural schedule?
And I know the parties have been working on a procedural schedule, so I guess at this point I would just ask the parties to see if they have any disagreements or if they've been able to come up with a procedural schedule.
Mr. Zork, go ahead.
On behalf of Sprint, Talbot White, Zorich, with Benderson, Palmer, Goodsell, and Nelson, the parties, I believe, have agreed to all dates with the exception of a decision date by the commission. I'll tell you that the parties had submitted dates back and forth, and if it's, I believe, a commission counsel, Wiest, has the ITC proposed arbitration schedule, and those dates are all correct as agreed to by the parties. I note that in my rush to respond to ITC and emails last night, I missed a couple of those dates, changing those dates under the proposal. What Sprint had agreed to as a hearing decision date originally proposed was April 30th, 2007. Swiftel, on some briefing dates, moved a briefing date back. We've agreed to the simultaneous reply brief being April 11th, 2007. Sprint would then agree to move back that hearing date, or excuse me, decision date from April 30th, 2 weeks back into May. ITC has proposed a commission decision date of May 25th. Swiftel in its proposal did not propose a commission decision date. So that's the one date we'd be in conflict on under the proposed schedule. The other part of the schedule, not so much on dates, ITC had originally proposed a procedural process that all parties should agree to and for exchanging the documents, how witnesses would be handled, exhibits, that parties would agree to a confidentiality agreement that would be entered into an order, and addressing aspects on how the commission would render their final decision, for example, an agreement that the commission would have full powers as sitting as arbitration, not be limited by an agreement as to what is referred to as baseball arbitration or last offer arbitration. We've exchanged that process. The one disagreement we have on that process, as it's attached to ITC's proposed arbitration schedule, which was provided, I believe, to Commission Counsel, is exchange of exhibits. Swiftel said they don't want to adopt any process but use the commission's rules. It's ITC proposed going beyond the rules and agreeing to some things up front. Sprint's agreed to most of that. Sometimes the commission rules are more general in nature. When we're exchanging a lot of documents in a tight timeline, I think it works better to have an agreement up front by the parties of how the documents are going to be exchanged, what the format they're going to be, and that addresses some of that because we're going to be sending back pre-filed testimony on a fairly short timeline. How to treat witnesses and how to treat exhibits, I think, is something that the commission rules aren't exact on, and it helps to have the parties pre-agree to that so we're not coming back to you over fights over, oh, I got a spreadsheet, but it's only in a PDF format, but I think it should be in the native format so I can read the formulas. But the one disagreement we have with ITC on that process is exchange of final exhibits, which has been tentatively scheduled for February 22nd. It's Sprint's position, but ITC originally proposed that we'd exchange all exhibits and the week before the hearing dates, and any exhibits not exchanged on that date could not be used in the proceeding. It's Sprint's position, because of cross-examination, that parties should have the right on redirect to enter a new exhibit or on cross-examination to use a new exhibit on cross-examination of witnesses. As I'm sure the commission can appreciate, there's often questions that come from staff or the commission that are unanticipated, or even the other side that are unanticipated. An exhibit that might clarify an issue that comes up out of the blue on how somebody calculated or made a determination, a cross-examination exhibit might be necessary to properly illustrate where an opposing witness, a party feels an opposing witness is in their pre-file testimony made mistakes or had an impact on how we calculated some of the numbers. So that's the one disagreement we have with ITC is on those exhibits. Sprint, or excuse me, Swiftel, like I said, is deferred. It would be our position with the Swiftel that the same procedure should be adopted for the Swiftel operation for a couple of reasons. I think it would be beneficial that these arbitrations, even if they are not combined, will go back to back by agreement of the parties. We have 4 days set aside. It would be worthwhile that the same rules apply for both arbitrations because the deadlines are going to mirror each other. The requests made in the procedure I do not see as being something extraordinary. It just addresses exchanging the discovery, what the timeline is going to be for exchange of discovery. For example, we're going to email everything, but we're also going to send every party's going to get one paper copy in case there's issues with email. There's a fallback copy coming along. These are things we've agreed to in other arbitrations. I think they work well. And I have copies of the proposals, the process proposal as set forth by Sprint. I can provide that to the commission if you want to look at it, examine it individually. Otherwise, I can certainly take comments from other counsel if you want to then look at the documents, whatever your preference might be.
Well, it's a little atypical just because procedural schedules normally are agreed to by the parties. So, Ms. Wiest, is there a particular standard operating procedure you would suggest we follow?
I think we could just go, well, you could certainly pass out those to the commissioners and then just hear from the other parties.
To make sure that I'm right, Ms. Wiest, there are two areas of disagreement. One, some of the dates at the back end of the schedule for both arbitrations, and then secondly, how to handle the new exhibits and redirect.
Between ITC and Sprint, let me take it on schedule. First, there has been no agreement between the parties about the final decision date. ITC had proposed the 25th of May. We had originally proposed April 30th, but in reviewing our proposal, as we've agreed to modifications on briefing, we agreed to push back reply briefs by 2 weeks, so we would also agree to push back decision date by those corresponding 2 weeks from April 30th.
Mr. Commissioner, this is James Overcast, too. If I could just jump in and talk about the schedule with Mr. Wiesorek, I don't believe there's an issue there, but if I could just be heard on that issue.
Mr. Overcast, we'll let Mr. Wiesorek respond to the question, and we'll come right back to you.
Thank you.
And so that's the only anticipated issue I think I had with ITC. And then the process, the procedural process on exchanging exhibits, ITC and Sprint, I believe, are in agreement on that process or that outline that I've provided the commission on the second page. With the exception of ITC, the exhibit issue on what exhibits have to be exchanged on the 22nd, whether you got to exchange everything and then you're barred from introducing anything else, or our position is we should be allowed to bring something in on redirect based on cross-examination or use additional exhibits for cross-examination. And, as to the procedure, Swiftel's taking the position that they don't want to agree to any procedure. They just want to rely on the rules as they exist with the commission. They don't want to agree to anything beyond it.
Thanks, Mr. Zwerk. Mr. Overcast, did you have something to add?
I did, Mr. Commissioner. First of all, on schedule, we did put in the date on the – I think all the parties have agreed on our briefing schedule. Question in terms of May 25th of your decision date, in terms of when would the parties extend the window until your decision date must be made. We did put in May 25th. From our standpoint, we'd be happy to agree to whatever date commission staff would think is reasonable. In that regard, we're not wedded to May 25th. We thought when we looked at the other schedule and pushing back, giving you an appropriate time frame to make a decision, we just put in the May 25th date. From that regard, so I wouldn't say that we have a dispute with Sprint in terms of what that date should be. We haven't really discussed it, and I think if commission staff would have a recommendation as that final date, at least from ITC standpoint, we'd be agreeable to that date.
Thanks very much, Mr. Overcash.
And do you want to hear on procedural?
Yeah, go ahead. Proceed, please.
On procedural process, Mr. Weisworks is exactly correct in that we have agreed on all the processes, and it's labeled A, B, C, D, and E. A, B, D, and E we've agreed upon. C, just from an exhibit standpoint, we do believe that the disclosure of all exhibits on the 22nd of February, which, again, we're talking about the Thursday, and the hearing begins on the next Tuesday, I believe. And so from the standpoint of that short time frame, but disclosure of the exhibits before the hearing allows for, we believe, a more efficient and fair hearing process. We've been involved in hearings that have gone either way in terms of disclosure of all exhibits up front or disclosure sort of exhibits on the come, or I don't use the term surprise, but allows for more gamesmanship and other items to be played. We think that if they were disclosed up front, it allows for a more efficient process because the parties have had an opportunity to review all of the exhibits before the hearing. We think it reduces surprise upon any witness from the standpoint of they've seen all the exhibits, hopefully, before the hearing. It allows for a more efficient process during their testimony and cross-examination. And ultimately, I believe the commission receives a more and better information and a more efficient and smooth process occurs before the commission during the arbitration process. Thank you, commissioners, for hearing my position on those two issues.
Thank you, Mr. Overcash. Any other commission, any other council wish to speak to either the procedural schedule or the procedural or the process?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, this is Ben Dickens with Swiftel, representing Swiftel today.
Yeah, Mr. Dickens, proceed.
good morning. I think that I would agree with ITC about the date for a final commission decision. I think that what ultimately the commission is going to have to render a decision after the last act of the parties, which would be the reply briefs. And we think you're in a better position to judge how much time you need to get that done as opposed to a decision by the parties. I would agree with Mr. Overcash's suggestion that the commission staff, as an initial matter, help you determine that. But whatever the staff or the commission decides, we think is appropriate. As far as process, Mr. Wazorik mentioned the fact that we didn't think it was necessary to have a detailed procedural agreement. That is absolutely true. We think the rules give the parties enough flexibility to work that out. We've never had any trouble working that out with Mr. Wazorik in the past. That having been said, there's been enough ink wasted over this that we're amenable to whatever the commission decides is between ITC and Sprint. The other thing I would mention is we do have a motion to dismiss pending, to dismiss an interconnection request that Sprint made. Depending on how the commission rules on that, we may come back to the commission and ask for an opportunity to present evidence that we have not presented based on our jurisdictional argument. And I guess I would just note that for the record, and that's all I have to offer.
Okay, thanks very much, Mr. Dickens. Staff, any comments on either the process or the schedule?
This is Kara Van Bachman for staff. No comments at this time. I'll defer to Ms. Least, and we're able to comply with whatever schedule is arrived at.
Ms. Least, in particular, I was curious about if you had a decision date that you thought would make the most sense.
Well, I guess the one thing I would point out is that we're dealing with arbitrations here, and I do want the parties to agree on a final decision date because they actually have to agree to extend that deadline to that date. So I don't think it's just up to the commission to decide it. If Sprint is uncomfortable with going to May 25th, then I would suggest that we push it back to perhaps May 11th or May 14th, which is, you know, about a month after the final briefs were due.
Let's go ahead and pick a date, and then we'll see if we can get all the parties to agree on it. I don't think it probably matters whether it's the 11th or the 14th. Is there a day of the week that's more appropriate between the two of them?
One's a Friday, one's a Monday.
Well, let's go Friday. That'd be the 11th?
Yes.
How do the parties feel about a May 11th decision date, Mr. Zork?
Grant would have no objections to that date.
Okay. Mr. Dickens?
That's fine, Ms. Swiftdale. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Overcash?
That'd be acceptable ITC, Mr. Commissioner.
Great. Thanks very much. Well, that was relatively easy, Ms. Weiss. Do you have anything else in your bag of tricks?
No. The next point, I'm afraid the parties aren't going to agree to. I guess I would be persuaded by Sprint's arguments on process. We have been through a number of hearings where unanticipated issues have arisen, and I don't think that the party should be restricted from possibly bringing in new exhibits on redirect or cross-examination. The one issue I would bring up, and I guess I would direct it to Mr. Wysorek, is would it be your intention that if you did have the exhibits done by February 22nd that they would be exchanged at that time, or even if you had cross-examination exhibits or, you know, that you'd already anticipated using, they wouldn't be?
It's often difficult to determine what you're going to use on rebuttal. Generally, the way I've seen this occur is occasionally something that's been exchanged in discovery that was never marked as an exhibit becomes relevant to be used for cross-examination. The problem that we're going to have with the 22nd, as I see it, is there's going to be some disclosures as to witnesses on that date, if potentially for any rebuttal witnesses or witnesses actually to address rebuttal testimony that was unexpected. So I think it would be difficult to say or guarantee that you would have your rebuttal exhibits even ready. I don't see a problem with if you have an exhibit prepared. Any prepared exhibits should be exchanged. But from the standpoint of getting an exhibit finalized, sometimes you can't do that until all the testimony's in and we know everybody's going to testify. So, you know, from the standpoint, if it's going to be a standard, something that's been disclosed in discovery, I don't think that should come as a surprise to anybody that something that's been exchanged in discovery could be used at the time of the hearing.
Yes, I would agree with that also. With that, I would suggest that the commission adopt Sprint's proposed procedurals schedule.
Okay, thanks, Ms. Weiss. Ms. Resort, you mentioned something about dates in the document you sent out yesterday not being quite right. Is this what you handed out? Is this
the there's the Sprint proposed there was, and actually Ms. Weiss pointed out to me two corrections that I missed. Discovery served would be December 8th. Designation of additional witnesses to rebuttal should be February 22nd. And that would match with the dates as proposed by Swiftel, adopted by ITC, and by Sprint.
Okay, are there any questions by commissioners or commission advisors for any of the parties?
This is James Overcash for ITC.
Yes, Mr. Overcash, go ahead.
I apologize. If Sprint's procedural process is adopted under paragraph E currently, it has the decision date April, and that would need to be changed to the date that you adopt. Just from the from a proofreading standpoint, you might look at that, or staff may look at subpart E just to make sure those dates line up.
Yes, and the other point I would make with respect to that is that they do state that the filing party shall provide the commission with a paper copy, and we don't need a paper copy. But I'll be writing up the order, and I'll put that in.
Thank you.
Yeah, and the question I would ask on that, and perhaps it's something you can clarify, is I had read that meaning that that would go to staff, and I don't know if staff wants just an electronic or wants a hard copy of it also.
We didn't ask staff, and we'll put it in order.
Ms. Van Bakken, did staff have a preference as to whether or not to receive something electronically or by paper?
Electronic is fine. Paper's not necessary.
Well, I'll attempt to cobble together a motion here, and Ms. Weiss, after I'm done, please correct me if needed before Commissioner Hansen hopefully has an opportunity to second it. I would move that the Commission adopt the Sprint proposed arbitration schedule with the two changes noted by Ms. Wazorek, as well as the addition of a May 11th decision date. I would also move that the Commission approve the process laid out and proposed by Sprint, with changes that a paper copy need not be filed with the commission, and that May 11th, 2007 would be the date of the commission decision.
Just a little clarification. That did not include any verbiage or intent to clarify when exhibits could be received, correct?
It would, just because I didn't strike Section C in the process laid out by Sprint.
So the exhibits, so which side of the fence are we on at this juncture? Are the exhibits allowed later on or not?
In the motion that I put forth, exhibits would be allowed in redirect or cross that were not provided to the parties on the 20.
I will second the motion.
Okay. Motion is made and seconded and carries. Next item on the commission's agenda is telecom number 4, TC06-181, and that's in the matter of the petition of Venture Communications Cooperative for suspension or modification of local dialing parity, reciprocal compensation, and reciprocal compensation obligations. Question is, today, how shall the commission proceed? And at this time, we would look to the moving party, which is Venture Communications.
Thank you. Good morning. Darla Rogers, appearing on behalf of Venture Communications. If Mr. Dickens is on the line, he also is representing Venture as well. And we filed a petition for modification or suspension, and one of the things that we said in our petition, specifically on page 14, that is with regard to modification or suspension of our obligation to pay reciprocal compensation, even on calls handed off to IXCs, that we were conducting a study to determine the percentage of toll calls that our inter-MTA, and what we had indicated there is that once the study was completed, we would supplement our petition with the findings of that study. This was also true with regard to symmetrical compensation, and that study would cover that as well. I would represent to you today that we have completed our study. It will be filed, I guess, at the latest within the next couple of days. We will be filing something to supplement this. Where I believe we are is that we would, of course, want this commission to make a decision as soon as possible on our request for interim suspension, because granting of that is just to maintain the status quo while you consider the actual merits of the petition for suspension. And so if the commission is you know, reluctant to proceed today, which I guess I think you could, but if you do not want to proceed prior to our actual filing of these final study results, we would urge you alternatively to establish a time as soon as possible when you would make a decision on our request for interim suspension or temporary suspension.
Great. Thanks very much. At this point, we'll hold questions and proceed to any comments that any of the other parties might have.
Mr. Commissioner, Talbot Weisort, Fenders and former Goodsell and Nelson for Altel and RCC interveners. I will tell you that it's difficult for us to comment on how to proceed today. We have yet to receive the exhibits that were marked confidential. As a way of background, when we originally obtained the petition that was filed, I noticed the confidential exhibits. I inquired of Venture's counsel whether they'd agree to a confidentiality agreement. We could start circulating it. They provided me a copy even before we filed our interventions. I provided them a signed copy. You might recall we filed our interventions late. They asked for additional time, but at that hearing, Ms. Rogers made a comment as to Altel. She wouldn't object, but she wanted to double-check RCC's filing. She didn't believe she didn't. So I provided her right away a signed confidentiality agreement on behalf of Altel. That's been 2 weeks now. When she filed her no objections to RCC, I provided her a signed confidentiality agreement on behalf of RCC. Since we haven't received the confidentiality, the exhibit she's marked confidential in the 10 days that she's had both of those, it's hard for me to comment on how long it's going to take. She now says that they're going to file a cost study. I'm assuming I'll get that when she files that, and hopefully the other confidential exhibits at the same time. Now, I envision it's going to take, we've got to take a look at it to respond, and that's going to take a minimum of a couple weeks, 20 days, for us to get them to people who can read them and for us to respond to any requests for interim. So I think this commission should not decide any type of interim decision until we've actually got the exhibits and have time to file a response, and then you have time to take at least arguments and potentially even some evidence in a short hearing.
Thanks, Mr. Rizorek. This time we would hear from staff. Mr. Best, Ms. Van Bakkeren, any comments?
This is Kara Van Bakkeren from staff. I agree that it would be difficult to proceed today. However, it's probably in the best interest of the parties to create a procedural schedule, and possibly that's something that could occur after this meeting.
And is it your intention this procedural schedule would just deal with the temporary suspension and a briefing schedule for that?
Yes.
Okay. Any questions for any of the parties by commissioners or commission advisors? I would have one for Ms. Rogers. Or two, rather. I have some reticence to grant an interim suspension without having an opportunity, you know, to receive, you know, briefs from all of the parties, which means we're probably not going to act today, and then perhaps not in the next month. Any comments or other issues you'd like to raise, as far as what you would see as far as a timeline?
Well, first of all, I do not believe it's necessary to brief the issue of a temporary suspension. And again, the temporary suspension, I mean, you have the authority to grant that. That's not a decision on the merits. I think that, in fact, you've done that in the past in the LMP cases where you granted an interim or temporary suspension so that, you know, the parties did not have to start incurring costs pending what you decided in the end. And I guess we think that this is a very similar situation to that. I don't recall, I mean, LMP has been a while ago, but I don't recall doing briefs in that case. So I guess I don't think that we need a briefing schedule. I think that we're in an interesting situation here with regard to, you know, we also have an arbitration petition pending, and that has been assigned to the Office of Hearing Examiners. We do have a procedural call set up on that tomorrow, and the decision deadline in that case is the 17th of January. So from our perspective, I would understand if you do not want to act on our temporary suspension request today, and I do have all the exhibits ready for Mr. Wysorek. I can turn them over, in fact, to him today if he wishes to stop at my office or has time to do so. I don't think that, however, is an impediment to bringing this issue on, and we would just urge you to, you know, notice that or give us a pretty tight time frame to get that issue resolved.
The decision, the arbitration decision, isn't scheduled to come out for, you know, 6 or 7 weeks. Is that right? January 17th, is that what you said?
17th, it's a decision deadline.
Decision deadline.
That's my calculation.
Is there any need prior to that date for a suspension?
We believe that an interim suspension is necessary, you know, yes, in the interim to maintain the status quo. And that so that things just keep on as they are right now. That's why we've requested it.
When would that status quo change absent action from the commission?
Absent action, well, the status quo could change in the hearing, in the arbitration process. Obviously, ultimately, that decision is going to have to be approved by you, but the other thing is that we do not have an agreement in place between the parties now, and so the status quo could change, certainly, if there are, you know, different demands made upon us by ALTA, because there's really nothing in place between the parties right now to maintain that status quo. That's why we've asked for it in the form of this petition.
Thanks. Other questions by commissioners or advisors for any parties?
This is Roland. We had a question. Do the parties anticipate that they're going to actually extend that deadline in the arbitration?
Not at this time. We have not discussed it.
Oh, okay.
Mr. Burke, did you have a comment? Let's go ahead and get you near the mic here.
I would just like to make clear that, status quo is kind of in the eye of the beholder. This is significantly different than LNP. In LNP, you had a situation where nobody was providing a service. And what you did was say, okay, you don't have to start providing this service. In this situation, you have Venture, who's basically already forced both RCC and Altel into situations where they don't have local numbers in certain communities, that you have to dial long distance to get a phone sold in that an Altel phone sold in that community in Venture situation. So they've created what they a preferred status quo for them, which we have serious issues with as to whether it's even a legal situation at this point. That's for Venture to simply get up and say, well, keep the status quo, let us do what we want to do, and let us force these providers into giving out numbers if they want to sell phones in a community and make people dial long distance to those numbers. I think you need to hear some more about this case before you jump to a conclusion that this is a maintaining of the status quo. I think the status quo, if the argument for the status quo is more that you have to provide local dialing parity. That should be the status quo. And Venture is not providing local dialing parity today.
I had a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
You go first. Does Altel or RCC intend to implement any changes that would affect these issues within the next month? If you can say.
Well, I not to my knowledge. The dialing parity issues are different, slightly different for both companies. I'm not properly explain all the technical aspects, but some of it has to be doing with trying to acquire, RCC is trying to acquire number blocks. WWC has number blocks that are assigned to an area, but as I understand it, Venture won't carry the calls in a way without charging long distance to their landline users to make calls to those numbers.
Anything more, Ms. Weiss?
Well, just not any more questions.
Okay. Any other questions for any of the parties? Any comments by commissioners or advisors?
This is Roland Weiss. My preference would be before the commission would grant a temporary suspension or deny it, that the commission actually hear from the other parties involved, namely RCC and Altel. And with that in mind, I would suggest that Venture, provide them with the confidential exhibits, assuming that everything's okay with the confidentiality agreement, and that we set some sort of a procedural schedule whereby RCC and Altel can respond in writing to the request for a temporary suspension.
Did you have a time frame in mind, or just leave that to the parties and staff to work out?
Well, I guess what I was looking at, and that was before I heard from Mr. Weisorg about the timeline that he was looking at, but I was looking at possibly, hearing it back on by the December 19th meeting. But it's possible that that might be too soon. So maybe it would be beneficial if staff would talk to the parties and see if they can work out some sort of a procedural schedule on this.
Yeah, this is Ben Dickens, co-counsel with Ms. Rogers.
Yeah, proceed, Mr. Dickens.
If we could indeed confer with the staff, I think we could probably come to agreement on a pretty quick procedural schedule.
Well, thanks, Mr. Dickens, and Ms. Wiest, I think I, like you, were trying to juggle the an interest in having a relatively quick decision on the suspension with an interest in trying to get additional information from the parties before ruling. So I would concur with that suggestion, and so would move that, or rather just instruct the staff to work with the parties to set up a procedural schedule. And unless you think some formal motion is required at this point, Ms. Wiest, we'll move on.
I don't think so.
Okay, great. Thanks. Next on the agenda is telecom number 5, TC06-182, and that's in the matter of the filing for approval of an amendment to an interconnection agreement between Quest Corporation and DIEC Communications, doing business as COVED Communications Company. And the question is today, should we approve the amendment to the agreement? And unless we have somebody from COVAD on the line, I would look to Ms. Van Bockern.
This is Kara Van Bockern for staff. The amendment was properly filed and executed. It doesn't appear to contain any discriminatory language. No comments were filed, and staff therefore recommends approval.
Wonderful. Any questions for staff by commissioners or advisors? Hearing none, a motion is in order.
I move for approval.
I would second the motion, which carries. Next on the agenda is telecom number 6, TC06-189. That's in the matter of the application of MCC Telephony out of the Midwest, doing business as Mediacom, for a COA to provide inter-exchange and local exchange services in the Castlewood, Elkton, Esteline, Hayti, Lake Norton, and White exchanges. The application is being made on behalf, the question is, shall the commission grant intervention to ITC? As the moving party, we'll look to ITC.
Thank you, Mr. Commissioner. This is Meredith Moore appearing on behalf of ITC. We have filed our petition to intervene in this particular matter because the service areas which MCC desires to serve are, in fact, the service areas in which ITC is currently the incumbent provider, and we simply want to ensure that MCC can, in fact, provide all the services throughout the entirety of that area and would like to have the relevant discovery information and ask any questions that we may need to ensure that those services are, in fact, covered. So we would therefore request leave to intervene in that particular matter. Thank you.
Thanks very much. At this time, we would look to counsel for Mediacom to see if there's any objection.
Good morning, commissioners and staff. Brett Kennecke for Mediacom. We certainly have no objection to ITC's intervention here this morning.
Thanks, Mr. Kennecke. Any objection from staff? Ms. Van Bockern.
No objection from staff.
Hearing no objection, a motion is in order, and I'll move that the commission grant intervention to ITC.
Second.
Motion is made, seconded, and carries. Telecom number 7, which is TC06-190, in the matter of unauthorized long-distance charges made by eChurch Network and iLab Technologies for their failure to obtain certificates of authority in South Dakota. The question is, today shall the commission issue an order to show cause? Ms. Van Bockern.
This is Kara Van Bockern for staff. I'm going to rely on the motion for a lot of the factual allegations in this case. I don't believe there's anyone on the line from eChurch or iLab. Mr. Lars Person out of California is the registered agent in that case for both companies. He's who both Ms. Gregg and I have been speaking with. We called him again yesterday in an attempt to get some sort of a reaction and a courtesy call just that today you're on the agenda. If there's an explanation as to why the companies build 60, 70 some odd businesses in South Dakota and why they're operating here without a certificate, we hoped he could be here to explain. He's not. If you have any specific factual questions, I'm going to rely on Ms. Gregg for those. She's put together a tremendous amount of information that's all here at the meeting, so I'll rely on her for those. But we need help in this case to enforce our rules and hope you'll grant our motion.
Thanks, Ms. Van Bocker. Just to clarify, and obviously I'm not prejudging the facts in the case, but in your filing you noted that there were 60 or 70 people who were charged, none of which we have evidence requested service from either of these companies or their parent company, and that the company doesn't have a certificate authority to even do business in South Dakota.
That's correct. that's correct. Ms. Gregg and I contacted, we started to top the list and just went down the list and contacted many of those that were billed, and we had differing stories from each person we called. Some didn't even realize they were billed, went back and looked at their records, and in fact they paid it, didn't know they had paid it. Some didn't think they were billed, didn't take the time to look at their bills, so we don't have for sure know whether or not they did pay it. And others remember specifically calling, disputing it, and it was taken off their bill, wasn't taken off their bill. The stories vary in extreme measures across the board for every single person that we called on that list. And again, we continue to contact Mr. Person to receive any sort of an explanation, because it could have, you know, it could have been a mistake. We wanted to know what the story was, and he couldn't answer, didn't answer, didn't return phone calls. So they don't know exactly who was billed, who paid it, who didn't pay it, but are hoping each church would maybe have some sort of an explanation at some point in this process.
Just, and I don't know, this is more a legal question that I'm certainly not going to be fully aware of, but is it appropriate to have the two companies listed as opposed to a single parent company? What's the appropriate docket name? And
both eChurch and iLab are registered in, was it Orange County, I believe, Radical Person, Inc., doing business as both of those. They register by county in California versus through the Secretary of State's office. So in conferring with counsel throughout the office, we made the decision to include both eChurch and iLab in the caption and the docket name.
Okay, thanks. Are there any questions, comments, or motions by commissioners?
Excuse me, Ms. Van Bockeren, how did you say they were registered in Orange County? Under what name?
Radical Person Incorporated is the parent company, we can call it, and he's registered in Orange County. That corporation registered in Orange County as doing business as eChurch and iLab Technologies.
And from one of your answers, it sounded as if you had spoken with the gentleman at one time. Have you spoken with him?
We have. We've spoken with him, both Ms. Gregg and I, on several different occasions. And in our original phone calls, it sounded as if he was going to work with us. We could get this resolved. He seemed sincere. He had some explanations. It was a computer mistake. It was a computer glitch. He would call everyone on that list, and they were going to make this right. He didn't call people. He didn't make it right. Those that he did call, he didn't follow through with. They never received a reimbursement.
Thank you. And to this juncture, well, what I was mainly interested in that telephone conversation, then he did not deny that they were the parent company of these two entities and that they did go through that billing process.
No.
Okay. Thank you. Just wanted to make sure we had the right animal.
Well, and maybe this is more of a comment, Ms. Van Bockeren, or maybe it's a question or suggestion, but because these are not actually separate entities, but they're merely fictitious names for Radical Person, Inc., do you think I think because they're a registered fictitious name, that's an appropriate name to bring the action in, but maybe we ought to just bring it in the name of Radical Person and DBA, both of these entities, mm-hmm. So we've got that ultimate entity, I guess the actual corporate name, on there. I mean, would you guys have any objection to doing that?
No objection.
And we're confident that these are DBA names for this entity.
Yes, and I have the document printed off of the Orange County site to show the registration. I could sure show that.
I might make that suggestion. I know when we got into S&S and some of that, later on dealing with, when we got into the court arena as opposed to here at the commission, and dealing with the actual entity structure when we hadn't really ferreted that all out early on in the process, it made things just a little bit more difficult, you know, to get it through the court's head, I guess, what it was. And so I might make that suggestion that maybe when we initiate an action here, we include that in the caption, if that's not unacceptable.
Nope, that makes perfect sense.
Any other questions, comments, or motions by commissioners or advisors?
I move that the commission issue an order to show cause to Radical Person, Inc. and eChurch Network and iLab Technologies as suggested by staff in the docket number TC06-190.
Second, motion carries. Next item on the agenda, Telecom 8, TC06-191. It's in the matter of Dish Network's failure to register as a telemarketer and the solicitations it made to those registered on the Do Not Call list. The question is, today shall the commission issue an order to show cause? Ms. Van Bakken.
We do have representatives from Dish Network on the line, so I'll defer to them first.
This is Dana Steele. I'm in-house counsel for Dish Network. Thank you for having us today. We did just receive notice of this show cause hearing yesterday by a phone call from, I believe, your office. Is that correct? I know we just received notice of it yesterday, and we're looking into all of the allegations right now. Initially, no, EchoStar is not registered as a telemarketer. There was confusion as to whether registration was a federal do not call register, because I know South Dakota tracks that was sufficient. We're currently aware that it was not, and we will are working immediately to rectify that. In addition, EchoStar is looking at the individual complaints, has performed preliminary investigation of the same, and is certain that in 11 of the 12 cases that it did not make the calls alleged, but will continue to research and see if it can provide additional information on independent retailers that might have made those calls with the assistance of the PUC. And takes these complaints obviously very seriously and would like to work to some type of resolution that's amenable to everyone involved.
Ms. Steele, this is Commissioner Johnson here and Pierre. I saw staff's filing. It didn't mention the relationship, or at least I don't remember it mentioning the relationship between EchoStar and Dish Network, and then you mentioned some other third parties. Do you want to give a brief overview of the relationships there?
I'd be glad to. Thank you for asking, actually. EchoStar Satellite LLC is an operating company. It's a Colorado limited liability company. It's part of the family of EchoStar Communications Corporation, the publicly traded entity that provides products, satellite television products and services under the registered trade name of Dish Network. So Dish Network isn't actually a company. It's our registered trade name that we license independent retailers who sign up, register, and sign our trademark license agreement to act as authorized retailers throughout the country. And then those third parties, when they make a telemarketing call, if that's indeed how they opt to market their products and services, which include Dish Network products and services, they're instructed to identify themselves not as Dish Network, because there is no such entity as Dish Network, but so-and-so retailer, an authorized retailer of Dish Network products and services. And what we're finding is companies, appear to be violating do not call laws and regulations and are hiding behind the name Dish Network. And we are working here what we believe very diligently to try to figure out who's doing that and get it done out. Because, it's hurting our name and reputation and certainly annoying consumers and entities such as the PUC.
Thanks, Ms. Steele. Ms. Embach,
is that helpful? Do you have other questions? Was that clear?
That answered my question. There may be other questions for you. Ms. Van Bakken did want to make a comment.
Okay.
My first comment, I guess, is regarding the notice. We made many attempts to contact them didn't receive a response. And in fact, we did serve this the motion and was signed for through certified mail at Echo on the 20th. So there was notice before yesterday, first of all. And yes, we, Deb and I, they made a courtesy call again to them yesterday to let them know you're on the agenda. Do you have an explanation? And that's when we first began speaking with Ms. Steele. We are currently still doing some research. As of yesterday, we were just aware of the relationship amongst all these entities that was just explained. Ms. Gregg and I are going to undergo some research and understand the relationship amongst all these entities and whether or not it is, in fact, Echo Satellite that is responsible for the retailers and the actions that the retailers have taken. We have gotten many complaints at state fairs, at county fairs, at home shows. Dish Satellite, there's been a lot, or Dish Network, excuse me, there's been a lot of complaints. So we want to understand the relationship amongst these parties and who really is responsible.
At this time,
Can I just comment to that?
Yeah, go ahead, Ms. Steele.
Yeah, and I agree completely that we did we show that these complaints were received by Dish Network, and as I stated yesterday in our conversation, you know, we are very, very sorry. What has happened, and in my investigation to figure out, we have an escalations process just for do not call violations. So it was very disheartening to me to find that these went to what was Sean Radcliffe, a person who claimed, a CSR who claimed he would handle them, and he absolutely just wasn't doing this. He is a technical support CSR, customer service representative, who really had absolutely no, he shouldn't have been claiming he could handle these complaints. And he was only in the executive resolution team for, according to my report as of last night, about 6 weeks. And, you know, that is inexcusable that these complaints were sent to him and they weren't forwarded on. And we don't know why he represented he would be the point of contact. And we would provide PSC with all of our contact information and demonstrate that we do have an actual active tracking process for complaints for this type of exactly for this type of complaint. And, you know, our sincere apologies, we'll give them an explanation of why these, you know, stopped with Sean and didn't make it to us and provide the active, the addresses for, you know, me personally and for anyone else who could get this, for complaints in the future. In addition, we did show that we had the notice to show cause, but since it went to kind of a general mailbox instead of a registered agent or something, it was simply being processed. And we did receive it, I guess, on this Monday the 20th, and with a holiday, I appreciate the courtesy call, I guess, is the bottom line. So,
thanks very much, Ms. Steele. Ms. Van Barker, do we know that we've got that? No is the wrong word, but do you think that we've got the right party at the table here to move to the next stage of proceeding as opposed to identifying particular retailers?
No, not sure. Therefore, staff would request a deferral of this, and Ms. Gregg and I will continue to research and find who we need to have at the table.
Great. Are there, before acting on that request, we'll see if there are other questions or comments.
Well, I have a comment, I guess, and maybe this was partially for you, Ms. Steele, but I think also that's John Smith, Commission Counsel. And I think it's important to distinguish between the issuance by the Commission of an order to show cause, which is just a decision by them to initiate a proceeding, and a determination of guilt. You know, I don't think we're even remotely to that point here. But I don't have any problem, you know, with staff's suggestion for deferral so we can make sure we get the right parties involved here. But I don't know. I mean, there's enough here to to recommend that an order to show cause go forward. So unless something happens between now and the deferral date, that's probably where I'm going to come down on this.
I would add, thank you. Commissioner, if I could comment on that?
Please.
Oh, thank you. I would simply like to say that it, just on the faces of the complaints, if we had the opportunity to show you, you know, something, it's, you know, such as I'm receiving calls from a number 800-232-3232, then we can provide, as I said yesterday, an affidavit or something that we've never owned that number. We've never used that number. And that was a number that was listed in several of the complaints. So I think just at a minimum, if your, I know we would certainly appreciate the deferral to further investigate at least the complaints on their face, and then you know, maybe weed out any that you find to be more problematic than others. But I think some, you know, immediately, you know, just on the complaints, we could provide an explanation and proof that it absolutely was not EchoStar Satellite making this call.
Other questions or comments by either commissioners or advisors? Question to either Mr. Smith or Ms. Van Bakken. Are there any efficiencies gained by us issuing an order to show cause? None? Okay. What I was going to ask, is there any efficiencies gained by us issuing an order to show cause and then allowing you all to gather more information while that proceeding moves forward? But then Mr. Smith has non-verbally indicated no, and I'll give him an opportunity to make that statement verbally.
Well, I think on the certainly we'd like to have the we'd have to at least have the right legal entities named from the DISH Network standpoint. And in response, Ms. Gill, I really do want to emphasize, you know, that just the issuance of an order to show cause, that just is a commission-initiated proceeding. It doesn't mean we're adjudicating you as guilty of anything. I would note, however, and this has been in the slamming and cramming context as opposed to do not call violations, but we've had a number of cases in the past where, in fact, I would say most of them that we've had in the past have been either third-party call center vendors, agents, that kind of thing. So, I mean, that it may be that that's what we'll get down to in this case, is determining what the relationships are between the parties and to the extent to which the big guy in the block, you know, namely you, has to take some responsibility for policing your vendors out there. You know, I mean, that's possible. I'm not saying it is, but it's at least something to think about.
And from a business standpoint, we would absolutely like to work with you. And again, if our actions by Mr. Radcliffe don't mirror that, obviously it's in, as I said, our best business interest as well as a corporate citizen to work with you to try to figure that out. And we can talk about legal responsibility. As we look at each one individually.
Thanks very much. Unless there are any other comments or questions from commissioners or advisors, a motion is in order, and I would move to defer this item.
I'm struggling with whether I'm compelled to say something or not. I guess I. It appears I am compelled. Having heard Ms. Steele's statement at the beginning that our staff was dilatory in providing information to them, notice to them of the meeting and the challenges, I would have instead led off with the fact that that I had not received information from my CSR at the company and that a disengagement had taken place relative to the standard operating procedure that was in place and that should have been followed at the company, as opposed to leading off and making it appear that notice had not been received on a timely fashion. And
I'm sorry if I meant that. I've never meant to represent otherwise. I was just saying if I wasn't prepared for this meeting, that was because I just received the information personally yesterday. Never trying to represent that the company didn't have the information. And I'm sorry if that came out wrong.
I'm not the person to accept your apology, but the way it was presented certainly gave the impression that you were intending to imply that the staff people had not done their work properly, and that does discredit the... Certainly, I'm not prejudging anything here. It sounds like you have relatively good explanations, but it is disconcerting and would provide some discrediting to come out and attempt to make that type of an argument right off the bat, your very primary discussion. So I'm sure that staff people appreciate your explanation and apology.
Oh, I can't apologize enough. That was absolutely not what I was trying to say. I was only trying to excuse my failure for being prepared and to talk on the merits of each individual case today.
Second motion.
Motion is made and seconded and is carried. That item is deferred. Unless I'm mistaken, I think we're at the bottom of our agenda for Telecom 1, which was moved to the bottom. And that is in the matter of the establishment of switched access revenue requirements and dockets TC04-119, TC05-096, and TC06-079. Question before the commission is today, shall the commission approve the revised tariff sheet? Those tariff sheets were submitted by LECA, so presumably they are up to bat first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When we presented a stipulation agreement to you, I believe it was a couple of weeks ago, I gave you a little bit of the history behind what went into the negotiations of an agreement. I'm not going to reiterate that today. I would tell you that an issue was raised by staff after approval of the stipulation as submitted to and approved by the commission, and the issue has come up that has arisen relates to rate elements. I would tell you on behalf of LECA that when we negotiated the agreement as you approved it, that we did not negotiate or include rate elements in any of those negotiations. We do not believe that the rules require rate elements. This is a negotiated flat rate, and the rate elements that are in our rate now come about as a result or are determined by the cost studies. In this case, we do not have cost studies, so we believe it is appropriate to have a single flat rate, and that is, as I stated, what we negotiated. We believe that this settlement agreement is beneficial to all of the parties, including and maybe especially for the IXCs. So where we are today is that we did file our tariff pages with a 12.5 cent flat rate that is consistent with the settlement stipulation as approved by this commission, and we are asking you to approve the tariff as it has been filed. I would also just point out to you that this is not a permanent arrangement. It is an interim settlement pending some type of revisions to rules either at the state or federal level. We can certainly address any issues or questions that arise within those proceedings, especially in the state rulemaking docket. I would also advise you that I have two members of the stipulation committee here today in person. They worked hard on the settlement agreement. The third party of the stipulation committee was on the phone. I'm not sure if he's still with us. The president of LECA is on the telephone, as is our consultant, and collectively we'd certainly try to answer any questions you might have. Thank you.
Wonderful. Before we move to questions, I would just ask if any of the interveners, other parties to the settlement stipulation have any comments. I mean, obviously this is a slightly different part of the proceeding with tariff sheets, but I'd still like to hear from them if they have anything to add.
Thank you, Commissioner. Brett Kaneke, appearing on behalf of both Midco and MCI Metro here this morning. I would agree with Darla's or Ms. Rogers' characterization of our discussions revolving around the settlement in the terms. We always spoke in terms of a total rate of 12.5 cents. Past that, I would offer that it is, as you describe, a matter of the tariff sheets in between the commission and the LECA members. I would only speak further to state my client's desires that this matter be wrapped up, that the rate be put in effect, and we get this matter closed up as soon as possible and not be drug out or delayed any further than necessary, any more than necessary. So that would be my client's overarching concern, is that this matter just be finished up and put to bed and the rate put in effect.
Thanks, Mr. Kennecke. At this time, I think it would be appropriate to hear from staff, Mr. Best, Ms. Kramer. Any comments?
This is Harlan Best with staff. When the stipulation was in final form, the concern that I had, and I believe that Mr. Sanger also had, was that there may be individual long-distance companies that do not pay or have not been charged a rate element within the LECA tariff sheets. And with an overall rate of 12.5 cents, that company may see an increase in their what they pay to LECA. And that's where I was coming from when I requested that the LECA provide a individual rate element, was the concern that there were companies out there that weren't paying all three rates.
Thanks, Mr. Best. I think we may have some questions at some point that enter into confidential material. I'll try to notice when that happens, but please, somebody feel free to interrupt, and we can go into a confidential session if that's needed. Mr. Best raises a pretty important point, I think, sort of who pays, whose ox gets gored. And if we can talk about that, without going into confidential session, obviously we need to. Does anybody have any insight into the commissioners as to who is currently buying just one or two of the elements rather than an entire bundle of three? And were they, and maybe most importantly, were they parties to the agreement?
I believe I can answer your questions. I'm just wondering if maybe we are moving into some confidential areas here that perhaps we should go into executive session, and then I will certainly be happy to address your questions as best as I can.
Unless Commission Council have any objection or want to raise any concerns.
Well, I don't. I think if we're going to talk specifics, and I don't know, but what I looked at, I know, Darla, and just preparing for today to try to get to figure out, and I'm not doing this to beat anybody up. It's just to try to understand. Bottom line, I think for us, one concern we have is when all of a sudden we levy at a 12.5 cent rate, if somebody's maybe been paying 8 cents. Are we going to have somebody out there screaming bloody murder and upset this whole apple cart? And that's kind of the concern, and whether there's a solution we can have here. But we may have to, in order to dig into it a little bit, I think what we want to understand is just, are we facing the potential for that? If we aren't, I think everybody here wants to accommodate the stipulation in as simple a form as possible. I think we really do. But we just don't want to walk down the road of having everything turn into a brouhaha. But we may have to discuss some specifics in order to know what we're looking at. One other thought I had, too, if I could just bring this up, because this is just a pure legal issue, okay? I mean, one concern we had was maybe just a technical one. And from my own probably naive point of view, I mean, when I saw the stipulation initially, first of all, I really applaud you guys, and I loved it, to see it, because I think it's the right track. My perception at the time was that, and again, I wasn't privy to any discussion, so I don't know what you guys talked about, but I was under the impression that a tariff sheet would be filed and that it would be carved up, that 12.5 cents would include the three rate elements. You never said that or anything. It was just in my head, that it would be like they all are, and so that's what I assumed we'd see. And that, in a way, that's for me what initially kind of triggered off my questions and thinking about it. In talking it over and looking at the rules, I know we do have a rule, and it's 2010-2903, which does state that access charges are to be divided up into these three components. And my question is this, that if we approve a tariff that doesn't do that, should the commission also explicitly make a waiver finding, which it can do on its own motion under 2010-2702, which allows it to waive any provisions of its rules and its switched access rules that are in conflict with what it wants to do? Do you think we should do that as kind of a safety valve, or have we already done that in approving the settlement stipulation?
I don't know that there's a 100% exact way that you should proceed, and I'm certainly not here to tell you what that is. I believe that probably in approving the stipulation as you have, it's certainly an implicit waiver. However, if there is a rule out there that you feel we are not in compliance with, I believe that you can certainly grant a waiver of that rule. If you don't wish to do so on your own motion, LECA can certainly file a motion requesting that in approving this, that you waive that any requirements of that rule, and we would be willing to do that.
Perhaps we'll take any questions. We'll set my question aside and take any questions that need to be in an open meeting format. Any other questions by commissioners or advisors? Hearing none, I would move that we go into a session to discuss confidential information. And at the end of that time, we'll come back on the Internet, obviously, and go back into an open meeting.
Second.
Motion is made and seconded, and we'll shut off the Internet and clear the room of those people who... hold on a second. We need to, prior to moving into that session, we need to determine who is on the phone yet and who shouldn't be. Mr. Colbeck, I think we're probably going to have to ask you to get off the line.
That's not a problem.
Thanks. At this point... Who is on the line other than Marlene Bennett, Denny Law, and Jerry Reisenauer? Is anyone else on the line? Ms. Rogers, would you prefer that we believe at this point we only have Ms. Bennett, Mr. Law, and Mr. Reisenauer on the line? If you want, we will call down to the Bureau of Information and Telecommunications and verify that there are only three people on this line. Oh, and... There you go. And Ms. Moore, I suppose, her clients are a party to are in the LECA pool, but she may be off the line anyway, so. She's not? Okay. Okay. Yeah. Okay, well, let's make sure we've got the right four. Mr. Law?
Present, Commissioner.
Great, thanks. Mr. Reisenauer?
Present, Commissioner.
Okay, Ms. Bennett.
Present.
Well, the three of you and us makes four, so that's great. At this point, we would move into a session to discuss confidential material. We are back on the Internet here at the State Capitol at the Public Utilities Commission meeting, and we have finished our discussion of confidential material, specifically which the distribution of minutes and what kinds of companies were taking one or two rate elements rather than paying for the entire rate. Questions or comments by commissioners or advisors? Greg, did you have anything else? Anything from staff in conclusion?
This is Keith Singer from staff. Much of what we've heard today, staff is hearing it for the first time too, because of the timing and the filing of the tariff and everything. However, staff does have a few other issues that I think are going to not have impact on LECA or the LECA members, but will impact the commission itself in moving forward with a flat rate, if that's how you choose to go. One is, how do we handle 2010 or ARSC 2010-2712, which talks about the average schedule. LEX can come in and adopt the average schedule, since use what that rule reads, everyone under the 100,000 access lines. And we refer to that as the LECA plus rate. Well, currently we may have some CLEX coming in here wanting to adopt the LECA plus rate, and now we don't have elements. So it's going to carry farther than just LECA. The commission and staff will have to try and decide how we're going to work with that. Another question that arises down the road is, you know, there's a lot of unknowns out there regarding the Missoula plan and everything, and whether or not the state is going to be forced into having a state subscriber line charge without a carrier common line specific charge. How do we go with that? Where do we go from there? Maybe it might be better to not have that rate specific at this point. It may be better for South Dakota in the long run. I don't know. It's an unknown out there, and we don't know how to handle. The other thing that I just want to mention that we kind of alluded to earlier is, when a company comes in and now they're going to be charged for essentially all three elements instead of a breakdown element, it appears to me there might be some conflict on there and actually penalizing companies who actually have facilities based in South Dakota that actually have facilities here. I have not spent a lot of time thinking about that or trying to flesh that out, but it seems to me that the only way you're not going to get charged all three rates if we have a specific element is if you have facilities base. And, you know, there may be an incidence down the road where we have someone who has their own transport or someone has their own switch. They're still going to be paying the 12.5 cent rate, even though they have their own facilities in state. And I can't specifically point to a circumstance where that's going to happen today, but what may happen tomorrow, we don't know. Unless Harlan has any other, I can't think of any other specific things to the top of our head that we have concerns with.
Those are indeed some key issues and areas of concern. I would just see if any of the parties have any responses with regard to the complications that Mr. Singer raised. Mr. Singer, how would, I mean, if the commission were to approve this tariff filing, what would be your best guess on how we would go about dealing with those average schedules and the LECA plus rate?
Staff has not specifically discussed this, so I mean, I don't have a specific answer, but I can perceive several different methods of doing it. The commission itself may have to break the rate down at the advice of commission staff, as far as those who are non-LECA members, because certainly when we have a CLECA, and I believe there's some problems with the rule itself that I talked about, but no need to get into there. But essentially what can happen today is someone who's coming into Quest service territory can actually adopt the LECA plus rate So it would be the total of the 12.5 set right now, and which, going into the Quest Service Director, I don't necessarily agree that they should be doing that or be allowed to do that, but that's the way essentially the rules read now. And if they're going to be a CLEC involved, and let's say they have their own transport and switching, now we're allowing a CLEC to charge 12.5 cents, but yet they're going to have to be using Quest. I don't know. It causes confusion in my eye. And I can see where the commission may have to break that down, and using a method that staff believes might be appropriate. That's the only way I can see around it. And, you know, in relation specifically to the CLECs or even some of the small rural ILECs out there who choose to adopt the LECA Plus rate.
Thanks. Mr. Rislav, did you have something to add?
Yes, I did. And maybe Keith would want to respond. But if we see a company coming in and wishing to charge a proxy, whether it be the Quest rate or the LECA Plus, if staff broke the rate down into elements, you know, based on, you know, some reasonable basis, and considering this company hasn't submitted a cost study, what really is the difference if the commission just determines those numbers on a reasonable basis, since they haven't filed a cost study anyway? In other words, if you pick three numbers that total up to 12.5, the LECA Plus rate, and separated by categories, what difference does it make if they are rounded, so to speak? Does that make any difference considering this company doesn't have a cost study to begin with?
No, and that's kind of what I was getting at, is what staff may have to do. But that leads to another question. The 12.5 cent is the LECA rate. We don't know how in the world we're going to determine what the LECA Plus rate is, because the LECA Plus rate before was determined with all of the elements, knowing all the minutes and everything and breaking it down, and now we just have a rate, and how do we back in the, I think it's two other companies to come up with the LECA Plus rate. But that's a non-issue. That wouldn't be solved if we break that down into elements either. We still have a concern there. But that's something I think we can work through. But I think Greg just maybe clarified what I was getting at, is we may have to do that. And I think there's lots of methods of doing it, and, you know, we can use averages and break it down that way. But the problem there, again, lies is, well, is that company now going to want to come in and say, well, I want to charge the 12, even though I'm only, you know, because there's the 12 rate, and there may be some problems involved there, too.
Other comments or questions, commissioners or advisors?
Does staff, either council or analysts, have a position on the waiver issue and whether the commission ought to grant a waiver of one or more rules, in assuming they're going to vote to approve the tariff? Do we need to do that?
I think you need to. This is Karen Kramer from staff. I think you do need waivers, and I do think you need to vote on them regardless if you, if we break it down into the three elements, you are meeting, I think it's under 29. Under the stipulation, they got their waiver of the cost study. But if you do go with the flat rate, I do believe there's probably one or more waivers that are required, and LECA should probably know what those are.
Would it be the belief that, I mean, can the commission do that via just a general waiver to state that we will waive this rule, which is the one that requires the three elements, and any other rules that are in conflict with this tariff, or do we need to list them all out and go through all that? I guess what I'm getting at is it'd be nice if we could just be done with this.
I understand right now, that. You know as well as I do how that goes down the road. Yeah, but you just said generically this, and so we think it includes this rule, and kind of like the situation we're in now. You know, what's a composite number consist of? I think specificity is better than general, but
I would concur. And I don't think it would take that much time to get a feel for which, if the commission chooses to act in that way, which rules would need a waiver. Any other questions or comments? You know, I think it might be appropriate, with your concurrence, Commissioner Hansen, if we take a brief 5-minute recess to receive advice from council and advisors, and during that time perhaps staff and parties could have those rules ready just in case the commission were to come back and act in such a way. Is that acceptable to you? Then we will be in a 10-minute recess, and we'll convene momentarily. We are back on the Internet and are done with our recess, which took a bit longer than we expected. Our apologies to everybody. I think everybody's still accounted for. We still have the phone lines for a while. Ms. Bennett, Mr. Law, Mr. Eisenhower, are you online? That's fine.
I'm still here.
Okay, great. Thanks, Marlene.
I'm still present as well, Commissioner. This is Denny Law.
Okay, great. Thanks.
And Jerry Eisenhower is still present, Commissioner, and in response to your question on if you have the phone lines, there was just a notification that the Constance Bridge will expire in 10 minutes.
Well, thank you very much. I don't think we'll probably take that long. I will just mention that I think there are some very real concerns about going with a flat rate. I think staff did a very good job of bringing them to the forefront. I mean, I do have concerns. This is clearly not the perfect scenario, but I don't want the perfect to become the enemy of the good. And I do think that there is a lot of value gain, a lot of good things that come about by having a flat 12.5-cent rate. And so with some concern, but not complete concern, I am going to move that we accept those filed tariff rates and that we waive the necessary rules. The ones that come to mind would be the requirement for a cost study and also the requirement that a tariff filing have 3 separate cost elements. And if there are others, I would certainly incorporate them in a motion. That those are waived.
Chairman, I share your stress or distress over the doing what is good versus what is perfect, and in a perfect world, this might not be the motion to make, but I will second it.
Before presuming that's final action, I guess I might just pause and ask the parties if there are other particular rules or components of the motion or staff, if there are parts that we should have incorporated.
Thank you, Commissioner. This is Darla Rogers. During the break, we did try to look at any rules that we felt would need to be waived. I believe in the settlement stipulation, you did already waive the rule that requires us to file the cost study.
That's right. I do remember that.
I believe that the only other rule, at least the only one that, other one that jumps out at this point that would need to be waived is 2010-2903, and that's the rule that sets out the rate elements. Now, there are other rules that refer to then how these particular elements are calculated or computed, but if you've waived the requirement that those rate elements be present, then I do not believe you would need to waive those other rules as well.
Thanks. It's my opinion that my motion doesn't necessarily need any amending or substitute motion. Great. Any other business to come before the commission? None has been noticed, so I would just note that we have a couple of announcements. The next regularly scheduled commission meeting will be held December 6th at 9:30 a.m. in room 412 here in the Capitol Building. I also note that commission meetings are scheduled for December 19th and January 2nd, 2007, and the commission offices will be closed Thursday, July 23rd and Friday, November 24th in observance of Thanksgiving. Thanks very much, and thank you to everybody for dealing with this difficult last docket item. We stand adjourned.